Yesterday, President Trump said that any more North Korean threats of missile deployment would be met with fire and fury. Well, North Korea responded with another threat. This hour, analysis on what happens next. It's a Politics Day edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. I'm joined this hour by political analyst Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. In addition to discussing the mounting tension between the U.S. and North Korea, we'll also talk about several legal battles in the works, including a crackdown on sanctuary cities and an Ohio case on voter registration. Stay tuned and join us for Politics Day after this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to be talking about all things fire and fury. And no, we're not talking about the dragons on Game of Thrones. This is Politics Day today, and we're going to be covering everything from the North Korean missile threat to several legal battles, including a crackdown on sanctuary cities and an Ohio case on voter registration. We'll also cover, of course, the latest on the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign. With me today, Rachel Caulfield. She's an associate professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
And Scott Peters. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good to be here.
And we want to hear from you. Does the latest threat from North Korea feel different? You know, we've had kind of several scares and threats in the past. Does this feel different to you? What are you concerned about this week? What are you curious to know in our political landscape? You can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send a message on our Facebook page or give us a call at 866-780-9100. Again, that number to call, 866-780-9100. So North Korea's nuclear ambitions have been clear for decades, as I mentioned, and now they're one step closer to realizing these goals. This week, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency indicated that North Korea finally has the capability to build a warhead small enough to be mounted on a ballistic missile. In response to new U.N. sanctions over its banned nuclear weapons program, North Korea vowed to retaliate against the U.S. And in response yesterday, President Donald Trump said they will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. Let's start with you, Rachel. What was your reaction to the president's reaction?
Well, I think obviously this kind of big, bold statement is consistent with how Trump talks about the world and how he talks about his administrative actions and what we can expect from him as president. There have been a number of people who have gone back and noticed that the phrase, like the world has never seen, tends to appear in a lot of his speeches. It seemed to be an ad lib. But there's no doubt that this is a really strong signal, and it's intended to be a strong signal to North Korea to say, look, you got to stop this. About 20 minutes ago, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis came out with a statement as well. It said that North Korea must cease consideration of actions that would result in the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. So clearly, this administration is trying to signal to the North Korean government, look, we will not accept this. And the hope, of course, is that maybe we can get to a table to have more productive conversations with the North Koreans.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, the president said, you know, any future threats will be met with fire and fury. And about an hour after he said that, yesterday, North Korean state-run media said the country's considering a missile strike on Guam. Is this a red line that Trump put out, and has North Korea already crossed the red line? Scott?
Well, I don't know about a red line. I mean, the thing to remember, I think, is that North Korea always threatens. It's sort of one of their main exports. And they, What's different, I think, about this is not the North Korean rhetoric. It's the American rhetoric. I think a lot of presidents in the past, the more bellicose North Korea statements have been, the calmer American presidents have been in their responses. I mean, that is to say, you can make it very clear that we keep all options on the table and that we're going to defend South Korea and of course, that we have seek to use military force as a deterrent on North Korean behavior, but you can do that without ramping up the rhetoric. And I think one thing that a lot of international relations experts are concerned about with this rhetoric is the kind of brinksmanship that it leads to. Because North Korea is not going to stop making threats. And if anything, it's just going to make the threats greater. The question then becomes, does the president feel like he has to do something to save face? Before too long, you can imagine a scenario that is sort of spiraling out of control, and that would not be beneficial to anybody.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking of rhetoric, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, he had kind of a more subtle approach to North Korea than the president. NPR reported that Tillerson said he thinks Americans should sleep well at night and that the U.S. and China agree that North Korea should not have nuclear weapons. He said that China's uniquely positioned to help put pressure on North Korea because of their economic relationship, but he does not blame China for the escalation. Here he is a little bit more.
We have reaffirmed our position towards North Korea, that what we are doing, we do not seek a regime change. We do not seek the collapse of the regime. We do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula. We do not seek an excuse to send our military north of the 38th parallel. And we're trying to convey to the North Koreans, we are not your enemy. We're not your threat, but you are presenting an unacceptable threat to us.
Rachel, how do you see Rex Tillerson approaching a sort of diplomatic strategy?
Well, so, you know, dealing with threats like this is always a combination of diplomacy, economic sanctions of some form or another, and potentially force, right? And so what I think we're seeing here, we're seeing very different messages come from different parts of the administration, which may be by design and it may not be by design. We don't know enough about how this administration functions in time of crisis, and we're so used to seeing disarray and confusion within the administration that I think there's some question about, you know, how well coordinated this is. But, Tillerson and the State Department, they are the diplomatic branch of the U.S. government. This is their job to engage in diplomacy. And so you kind of have a good cop, bad cop messaging strategy going on here. And like I said, I don't know if that's well coordinated or not.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to a couple other reactions on this issue. Senator John McCain said yesterday, he told Phoenix radio station KTAR that he's concerned about the potential threat North Korea could, you know, pose to South Korea, especially Seoul, a city of almost 26 million people. He said he takes exception to the president's rhetoric.
You got to be sure that you can do what you say you're going to do. In other words, the old walk softly but carry a big stick, Teddy Roosevelt's saying, which I think is something that should have applied, because all it's going to do is bring us closer to some kind of serious confrontation. I think this is very, very, very serious. And I think that the rotund ruler in Pyongyang, he's not crazy, but he certainly is ready to go to the brink.
So, Rachel, do you think the Trump administration will address the danger North Korean missiles already pose on the Korean Peninsula in that area?
Well, I think they have to. I think there are a number of interesting things going on here. The first, and I've said this before, there are no good options for the United States in dealing with North Korea. None. which is part of what has made this such an intractable problem for so long. And every president for several decades now has had to negotiate some sort of status quo arrangement. I think Scott's absolutely right. What's changed is American rhetoric here. But the other thing that's changed, of course, is that it appears the pace of the nuclear weapons program has proceeded much faster than we expected. And so all of a sudden, the threat level is much higher than it has been in the past. There's no question this administration has to deal with that. John McCain, I think, a senior statesman in the party, is in a position here to kind of say, look, let's all take a deep breath and let's make sure that we're dealing with this responsibly. And of course, because he's John McCain, that includes a quote from Teddy Roosevelt.
It's Politics Day today on River to River. We're talking about North Korea's nuclear ambitions and kind of the latest news in regards to that. If you have a question for our analysts or a comment, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You know, we talked about those, or I mentioned the UN sanctions to North Korea. These sanctions could slash its $3 billion annual export revenue by a third. And I'm curious, you know, have any previous sanctions on the country actually slowed, you know, them down in this realm, Rachel?
Well, we don't know for certain. Clearly, they have, those sanctions have proved to be a deterrent in some form. And that may be because the sanctions starve the nation of some needed resources that they could put into that nuclear weapons program. It may be because they realize that the international community, in a globalized world, the international community largely determines their long-term fate. And so economic sanctions then can push the cause of diplomacy and can kind of drag people to the to the table when necessary. There have been some talks about additional sanctions, including sanctions on oil imports. But the key actor here is China, because so much of North Korea's economic activity is dependent on China.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Scott, do you think China's support for these sanctions kind of marks a change in how much help that country might be in resisting North Korea?
I'm not sure if we can judge that just based on the fact that they voted for them. I believe there have been times in the past where China also supported UN sanctions against North Korea, and then pretty much just ignored them. I do want to go back quickly, though, to something you mentioned a minute ago about coordination of different parts of the administration. And Rachel's absolutely right. Another thing that is different here is the pace of North Korea's nuclear development. And it is concerning, I would say, that that the administration is so far behind in staffing key positions in the State Department and elsewhere in the government. So we, of course, don't have true diplomatic relations with North Korea, but and we have very good career people at the State Department, but the State Department right now is lacking key political leadership at important offices, the office that's in charge of East Asia policy, the office that's in charge of arms control. The Trump administration has made no nominations for pretty much the entire State Department leadership other than Secretary Tillerson.
And that's an important point. You know, we're about 200 days into the administration and, you know, the position's still not being filled. Is this, do we know from, you know, historical precedent, is this at all common for an administration, or is this pretty unique and possibly alarming? Rachel?
The Obama administration filled vacancies at a much higher rate, clearly, as did the Bush administration, as did the Clinton administration. So the very slow pace of filling these vacancies, both the appointed positions and those that require Senate confirmation, is unique. It's common for for any president coming in, you know, there are about 4,000 positions that have to be staffed by a new president. That's a huge number of people. But I think part of this is internal feuding inside the White House. There are some reports of names that have been floated and struck down by someone who's already in the administration. So there seems to be some sort of, you know, some personality conflicts that are driving this slow pace. But overall, Scott's absolutely right. When you have a crisis like this, this is exactly when you need those people most. When you need all hands on deck, you need some innovative thinkers, you need the people with the expertise who are there to guide these processes along.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, you know, many of our listeners are wondering, like I am, you know, how concerned we should be about this. You know, talking about military action, is there any sense that there could be any action, or is this just kind of, you know, Trump being Trump and, you know, making grand statements? So I'm wondering, you know, to each of you, how likely do you think it is that Defense Secretary James Mattis, the new Chief of Staff John Kelly, would sign off on any military action?
I'm going to let Scott go first with that one.
Do you want to tackle that one?
Well, that's a much more complicated question than it might seem. I mean, the president, of course, is the commander in chief under the Constitution, and if the president gives orders, you know, they are to be followed. That said, the United States military is first of all a big bureaucratic institution that has a lot of you know, it's not easy to control, and has a lot of resources at its disposal to implement president's orders. But when, you know, ultimately their biggest influence, I think, is in advising the president of what the proper course of action is. And one would hope that that's where they exercise their good judgment.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, you agree with that?
I do. I mean, this is one of those, I think there's reason to be anxious about the situation. This is a new age of our relationship with North Korea. And while we've been able to kind of keep this problem in a box for a while, it's emerging, and it's emerging quickly, and Americans should be concerned about it. At this point, I don't think the public would be supportive of military action against North Korea. Having said that, this is a situation that can change very quickly. And so I think, you know, we wait now and we see what North Korea does and we see what President Trump does. But obviously, the brinksmanship has started, and we have regularly scheduled military exercises that will be happening both North Korea and the U.S. So it's going to be tense for a while. But I got to tell you, I can't predict the future on this one.
You're usually so good at that, Rachel.
Yeah. I always defer to the other guests.
Yeah. We're talking politics this hour on River to River. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Zach is joining us from Moline. Zach, what's your reaction to this week's events?
Well, I just wanted to say that the scariest part in all this, I remember during the election, you had David K. Johnson on, who's a reporter on Donald Trump. And, you know, he called Donald Trump a world-class narcissist, and that was the basis of him running. And I feel like that's the scariest part, because I don't, like, literally think he is capable of feeling the burden of the office or the responsibilities associated with the presidency. And that's just what scares me going into all this.
Mm. All right. Well, Zach, thank you for your comment.
Zach is not alone.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, before the break comes up, it always comes up so fast. I want to get to a tweet that Trump tweeted out just before 8 a.m. Eastern time from his golf resort in New Jersey. He said, "My first order as president was to renovate and modernize our nuclear arsenal. It is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before." And in a second tweet, he said, "You know, hopefully we'll never have to use this power, but there will never be a time that we are not the most powerful nation in the world."
exclamation point.
There was an exclamation point.
Yeah, there was.
So, I mean, what's your reaction to that? Is that kind of quite a departure from President Obama's, plans for our nuclear arsenal?
Yeah, clearly our nuclear weapons and any country's nuclear weapons are, of course, the kind of front line of the most powerful military might that we have. I think several people have suggested that President Trump, in some ways, is speaking in a way that Kim Jong-un will understand, right? Bellicose language, big, bold statements. So some have suggested that that's intentional because those are the kind of signals that North Korean leadership will listen to. I think, again, clear signal to the North Korean government.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a few more calls before the break. Sin in Muscatine. Hi, Sin.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to share today? What are you thinking about?
Well, I was just thinking about the fact if the United States uses a nuclear weapon, whether it's a big one or a small one, it's just going to increase the fact that the rest of the world who has nukes, they may just use theirs too. And they think it's easier to use than the situation we have today.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, Sin, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
And Ralph and Grinnell, Ralph, you seem to share kind of an anxiousness as well in your question. Go ahead. What would you like to add?
Well, what happens to the world economy besides the U.S. economy?
What happens in what case?
Everything's all messed up. Well, if we can't get anything from Japan or whatever because they've been half-lifed off the face of the earth, it's not going to be a pretty picture. I'm not saying I support the North Koreans at all. It's just you can't go back in time and stop something you started.
Sure. Well, thanks for your call, Ralph. I mean, Scott, react to some of these callers. I mean, are we in another Cold War type situation? I mean, people
seem
pretty concerned.
I mean, it might be a little too early to say that, but I think as Rachel and I have both said, I mean, it is a tense situation. It's rapidly developing. I think the biggest concern of military planners and strategists for at least the last couple decades has been war on the Korean Peninsula. I think that has been sort of the worst possible scenario that they've been dealing with for a long time. And even if it were just a conventional war, it would be devastating. Through the use of just conventional artillery, North Korea could pretty much completely destroy Seoul. Any kind of war that would break out in that region of the world would be devastating, not only to the region, but to the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what are you going to be watching for in the coming months relating to this?
Well, I think, like I said, we need to kind of watch and see what the North Koreans' reaction is to these signals that they're getting. The fundamental premise in the nuclear age has always been this mutually assured destruction, right? This idea that if one country uses nuclear weapons, then that's the end for all antagonists in that particular conflict. So the premise of nuclear power then is countries have nuclear weapons based on the premise that they will not use them. So the idea that we now have a country that could potentially be joining the family of nuclear powers in the world that doesn't necessarily adhere to that premise is what's creating the sense of uneasiness right now. We don't know what Kim Jong-un will do.
Rachel Caulfield, she's a political scientist at Drake University, and Scott Peters at the University of Northern Iowa. Please stay there. We're going to be back in just a few minutes talking more. We're going to actually be switching topics, talking about the investigation into Russian influence in the 2016 election, about the news this morning, about the Manafort raid. Join our conversation, 866-780-9100. We'll be back in a minute. This is River to River from IPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village. an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Glad you're joining us today for a Politics Day discussion. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about President Trump's approach to combating the opioid crisis, the opioid, what many are calling, an epidemic in our country. If you have ideas and thoughts, questions about how this administration will approach this topic, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or again, give us a call, 866-780-9100. With me today, political analyst Rachel Caulfield, an associate professor at Drake University, and Scott Peters, an associate professor at the University of Northern Iowa. And it wouldn't be a Politics Day without us talking about the status of the Russia investigation. Last week, the Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller enlisted a grand jury in his investigation. Scott, remind us, what does a grand jury do and who makes up the grand jury?
Grand juries are summoned, they're citizens summoned for jury duty, and their purpose can be twofold. They can serve investigative purposes, so they can basically help prosecutors investigate whether wrongdoing happened. And ultimately, they can also issue indictments if they determined that wrongdoing happened.
And when we talk about who makes up the jury, where is this going to take place? Because depending on where you are in the country, people could worry that some people have certain political leanings. Is that a factor in this?
The independent prosecutor is located in D.C., where the Department of Justice is located. So that would be the normal place one would convene this. You don't get to, if you're being investigated for potential wrongdoing, you don't get to decide where the grand jury investigating you can be convened. You don't sort of get to say, I'd like this to be convened in my hometown where all my friends are, so everybody will be friendly to me. That's not the way it works.
Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that grand jury investigations can run a pretty long time. Any idea what kind of time frame we're talking about?
No clue. Something like this could go on for quite a while. I think, it's really important, and I stress this to my students, when we see all these different news reports about this investigation, read each report for what it is, look at the facts in the report, don't overgeneralize from one report about what you think might have happened. Just do your best to pay attention to every single report. So, it's an addition of facts. So this week, for example, the most recent things we found out is that there's a grand jury impaneled. We found out as well just today that the FBI served warrants against Paul Manafort, who was the campaign manager for a time of the Trump campaign. It's risky to infer too much from these things, right? But one thing you can infer from the fact that a search warrant was served, would be that there was enough evidence to go to a court to demonstrate probable cause of some kind of illegality. What that is, we don't know. So it's best, I think, to just wait, read the stories as they come out, and assess each story for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned, the FBI raiding the home of Paul Manafort, Trump's 2016 campaign manager, let's talk a little bit about that. Rachel, what does this signal about how Mueller's investigation will be run?
Well, I think it tells us a few things. It tells us, first of all, that they're not taking Manafort's cooperation for granted. Nor are they handling him with kid gloves. Typically, if a witness is happily cooperating, easily cooperating with an investigation, then there's no reason to do a pre-dawn raid at their residence. So some people have taken this as an indication that there's some evidence that has not been offered freely to the investigation. It does appear that some of the documents that were taken had been willingly offered to the Senate Intelligence Committee the day before. So it's unclear what new information they got from this raid. That's the sort of thing that, with any luck for Manafort, will stay relatively quiet for now. One of the benefits of a grand jury for those who are being investigated is that the workings of a grand jury are sealed. And so this is happening outside of public view, and that means it's a much more controlled environment.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this opioid briefing that I mentioned at the outset of this segment. Yesterday, President Trump met with health administration officials. He was briefed on the issue of opioid abuse in the U.S., and he told reporters afterwards that the best way to prevent drug addiction and overdose is to prevent people from abusing drugs in the first place. From reports on this meeting, Trump's focus on this issue is really on preventative measures and law enforcement, stricter law enforcement and abstinence-based measures. Scott, do you see sort of a resurgence of the Just Say No campaign of the 80s?
It's hard to say at this point. I mean, the president's remarks certainly reminded a lot of people of that. It's also notable that his remarks were not consistent with, if not downright contradictory to, the recommendations of the advisory panel that issued a report recently, which advised treating the opioid crisis as a public health crisis, and advised that one of the best ways to do that would be to increase access to Medicaid for people.
Mm. Rachel, what do you think about the administration's, kind of saying, no, we're not going to declare this issue, a national emergency, even though, the recommendation of the commission that President Trump organized said, it should be, a national emergency. Is there any sort of, what do we see historically when something's called a national emergency? Is it in cases like this?
Well, it certainly can be. There are no firm rules on this. And he could declare a national emergency tomorrow if he wanted to. So the fact that he hasn't done it already doesn't mean that he can't do it in the future. But declaring something a national emergency does lift some of the restrictions on spending and kind of how various administrative programs address a problem. It allows more interagency cooperation more easily. So there are some advantages there, but all of those advantages are things that could probably be managed within the executive branch of government without the formal declaration of a national emergency. So in some ways, this is a purely symbolic question of whether or not to declare the national emergency. I do think, it's important. When he was out on the campaign trail and he overperformed generally, there was a study out of Penn State that indicated that he overperformed generally in counties that had very high, that had the highest rates of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and suicide. This was mentioned often during the campaign. During the campaign, he seemed to indicate that he wanted to treat the opioid epidemic as a humanitarian crisis rather than a law and order question. And so, his budget proposal, which has proposed cutting funding for treatment, that seems inconsistent with that. The congressional Republicans proposed cutting Medicaid completely contradictory to the report that was given to the president on the opioid epidemic. So, it's unclear. There are a lot of mixed messages being sent here regarding how to address this epidemic. I do think, he followed up yesterday by saying, the real answer, we need to be telling the youth no good, really bad in every way. That's great. I grew up. Yeah, exactly. That's true. And I grew up in the 80s and I remember very well the Just Say No campaign. And to date, it has not answered all of our problems. It has not ended drug addiction in the United States. So I think it's fair to say that we need to move beyond that message.
And we'll close this by, reading an email from Andy in Marion. He said it seems like one of the best ways to combat the opioid crisis would be to legalize cannabis. Studies show that legal cannabis can reduce opioid overdoses by 25% to 50%. Worryingly, Jeff Sessions continues to threaten a cannabis crackdown, something that could further exacerbate the opioid epidemic. That email from Andy in Marion. I want to move on to a Supreme Court case. Scott, this next question is for you. Reversing an Obama administration stance, President Trump's administration says it will support Ohio in its bid at the U.S. Supreme Court to bring back a policy of purging people from voter registration lists if they don't regularly cast ballots. Remind me, why did Ohio bring about this policy?
Well, first of all, I think it is a policy that's been in place in Ohio for some time, maybe 20 years or so. I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's been enforced the exact same way that whole time, I don't know. As I understand it, the policy basically works like this, that if you don't vote in 2 years, then a mailing goes out to your last known address to verify your registration. And then after that, if you don't either respond or vote for 4 years, you get purged from the rolls. There was a lawsuit challenging this. The argument was that it violated the motor voter law from 1993, which expanded registration of voting. And an appellate court, a U.S. Court of Appeals court, struck down the law. The Obama administration had been arguing that it was unconstitutional, not unconstitutional, but that it violated that 1993 law. The Trump administration has now reversed that, and they will argue on behalf of Ohio that it does not violate the law. And their argument is that it doesn't violate the law because a voter isn't purged after 2 years. They merely get that verification. And so that case is headed to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And I could see, depending on which side you're on, and often that means, you know, red or blue, you're either seeing this as, hey, this is a way to kind of keep our voter rolls organized and efficient, keep them up to date. And then on the other hand, you could see it as, you know, you're suppressing voters who may not be organized enough to, you know, be on top of this, but still need the right to vote.
Certainly. And you know, your right to vote is not contingent on whether you voted recently or not. I mean, if you're an eligible voter, you're an eligible voter. Of course, states have registration rules as well. And so the question for the Supreme Court is going to be whether the particulars of that law that protected the registration system have been violated here. I think, you know, certainly one of the dangers of laws like this is that if they are enforced too vigorously, you can end up with a lot of false positives. You can end up with people who, in fact, even have voted getting purged from the rolls. We've heard stories about that, and I think there were multiple instances that came up during the Ohio litigation where voters who even had voted during that period got the postcard indicated that they hadn't voted. So that would be one of the dangers here.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel, what do we know about, you know, I mentioned that, you know, this could be a partisan issue. What do we know about the partisan politics of this case?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about the partisan politics of this case. And the fact that the Obama administration backed the challenge while the Trump administration is backing Ohio is essential here. It's not uncommon for administrations to use the Office of the Solicitor General and participation in court cases to signal their policy preferences. And so this reversal by the Justice Department is not a huge surprise. It's a direct result of a different party being in control of the White House. There's really no question about that. And this is one of those circumstances where the claims of both sides are legitimate. Managing voter rolls is an exceptionally difficult job for the states. When people move, they don't re-register automatically or all the time. And so if you're a state, you know, a state official who's trying to keep track of who is where and where they vote. That's an exceptionally difficult job. At the same time, Scott's absolutely right. Just because you haven't voted for a little while doesn't mean you're not eligible to vote, and it doesn't mean that your voter registration is no longer valid. And so, well, in this case, it might mean that your voter registration is no longer valid. But, yeah, your eligibility should not be questioned simply because you don't participate. So both of those claims are legitimate claims.
If you just tuned in, this is River to River on Iowa Public Radio Politics Day. I'm joined this hour by Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. Cracking down on sanctuary cities could become one of the next major legal battles against a Trump policy. Specifically, sanctuary cities are now suing the Justice Department over the administration's threat to deny funding if they don't cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. Scott, tell me a little bit about this suit. Who are the sanctuary cities that are involved, and what are they claiming?
The most recent city to file suit was Chicago, and there are several others. But the Trump administration had indicated that certain grants that the federal government gives for law enforcement would be withheld if cities didn't do several things to aid immigration enforcement. One of them is allowing basically at-will access to police departments and jails. Another one is holding suspects whose immigration status is in doubt for at least 48 hours after they've been notified, after they've notified ICE. There are a few other things. So if cities don't do these things, the Trump administration said they would withhold certain grants for law enforcement. The city of Chicago in that recent lawsuit, and this is consistent with other lawsuits or challenges that have been made, they are arguing that this violates key aspects of federalism. The division between state and federal authority. They argue that the federal government doesn't have the authority to tell the state government how to enforce its laws. There are also Supreme Court cases that indicate that the federal government cannot coerce or commandeer state officials to enforce federal law. And there are also Supreme Court decisions that indicate that the federal government can't use their spending power in a coercive way to force states to adopt policies that the federal government likes. So all of these basic principles of federalism, state-federal relationships, are at issue here. And I'll just say in closing on this part that immigration has been a hot point for state-federal relationship for quite some time. The Obama administration's immigration policy was challenged by several states. Now we have the Trump administration's immigration policy being challenged by states and cities.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have some comments from Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He was saying that, you know, this latest effort to withhold federal money from sanctuary cities amounts to blackmail.
Chicago will not let our police officers become political pawns in a debate. Chicago will not let our residents have their fundamental rights isolated and violated. And Chicago will never relinquish our status as a welcoming city.
Rachel, what's your take on this? You know, what are you going to be looking for in the next few months?
Well, so this is clearly, right, there's this whole bundle of immigration proposals that the Trump administration is working toward in its efforts to reform the immigration system. So that includes the proposal to cut legal immigration that was announced last week. It mm-hmm. obviously includes the travel ban, which has been, of course, tied up in the courts. And well, we should have a decision from the Supreme Court next year, which seems like a very long way away, given how fast the news is moving these days. And of course, we have this new sanctuary city question, largely being funneled through the Justice Department and Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions, you know, given how much, given how acrimonious that relationship seemed to be last week, Jeff Sessions really has been one of the cabinet officials who's been the most effective in actually executing Trump's policy vision. And this is one example of that. You know, I think at this point we wait, we see what the courts end up saying here. We have some clues from some federal courts in San Francisco and elsewhere, but there are some mixed responses by the courts. And so, you know, this is their job to step in when we have these sorts of legal conflicts, and legal conflicts that invoke big institutional design questions like federalism.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. I want to ask you both kind of a lightning round question here at the end of the conversation. You know, the New York Times reported that two of Pence's, Vice President Mike Pence's aides have told other Republicans that Pence, quote, wants to be ready to run for president in 2020 in case the opportunity arises. Your reaction to this, Scott?
I guess not terribly surprising, and also possibly brilliant because he gets to possibly make plans even while he can denounce the New York Times as fake news.
Rachel, what's your take?
I think, quite frankly, the Republicans would be silly to not be envisioning what happens in 2020. Mike Pence seems an obvious choice. And for those of us here in Iowa, the fact that he showed up for the Roast and Ride this summer, none of us should be surprised that these conversations are happening behind closed doors at this point. This is to be expected.
Well, we will see. I'm sure those campaigns will start sooner rather than later.
Yes, they will.
Yeah. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
And Scott Peters, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Emily. Thanks, Rachel.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. Our theme music is composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.